Good morning. President Trump says a deal to end the war with Iran will be signed in a few days. Unlike some other announcements, Iran confirms this. What's actually in the deal? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Oil prices are falling, a bet that the deal will reopen the Strait of Hormuz. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Amy Martinez, but with oil fields and refineries in the Gulf damaged during the war, prices are not expected to go back to where they were back in February. Also, Iranians in L.A. are deciding whether to cheer for Iran in the World Cup. And people who want to build data centers say China is behind the pushback that they get. However, the evidence is not on their side. It's Monday, June 15th. On this day in 1938, Cincinnati Reds lefty Johnny Vandermeer became the only major league pitcher to throw back-to-back no-hitters. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. and Iran have reached an agreement to end the war. President Trump says it will reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He says there will be a formal signing of the deal this Friday in Geneva. The text of the agreement has not been released. There appear to be outstanding issues, including the fate of Iran's nuclear program. President Trump is now flying toward France to attend the G7 summit. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports security will be tight.
Thousands of protesters turned out Sunday in neighboring Geneva, Switzerland, against what they say is the over-concentration of political and economic power in G7 nations. The French town of Évian-les-Bains is under lockdown and practically deserted as it prepares for the arrival of leaders from the U.S., Canada, France, Germany, the U.K., Italy, and Japan. The 2 days of meetings will be secured by thousands of French riot police, cybercrime, and anti-terrorism squads, bomb disposal units, drone pilots, helicopters, and close to 1,000 military personnel from the French Air and Space Force. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Before he left, President Trump hosted a UFC fight night on the White House lawn last evening for his 80th birthday. The White House says it was to celebrate the nation's 250th birthday. Trump's critics say he brought a brutal sport to the White House, but thousands of fans showed up to cheer. Karim Zidane says this is a big step forward for the mixed martial arts organization.
The UFC is making a significant statement here. It's a political one, saying that it has emerged as a true political force within America, and it's reaping those benefits. It just recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the State Department. They're going to begin these sports diplomacy initiatives. That is formally integrating the UFC into foreign policy, into its soft power strategy.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. The president's name has been removed from the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Trump had ordered his name to be placed on top of former President John F. Kennedy's on the Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports Trump's name was removed after he lost a court battle.
The grounds of the Kennedy Center were quiet Sunday afternoon. Blue striped tarps remained draped over the building's marble facade, where workers had removed the letters spelling Donald J. Trump and in compliance with a court order.
They should never have been up in the first place.
Teacher Monica Brooks says she wanted to see the center restored to being named solely for President John F. Kennedy.
It's a memorial for a dear president that died. You know, it's like putting his name on his grave. You know, it's bizarre.
A federal judge ruled only Congress has the authority to change the name. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell was hospitalized yesterday. His office says he is receiving excellent care, but didn't say if McConnell was hospitalized in Kentucky or in Washington. The statement did not say why he was admitted. The health of the former Senate Majority Leader has been tracked. McConnell was hospitalized in 2023 with a concussion after falling. He later twice froze and stopped speaking in the middle of news conferences that year. More than half of parents of young adults say they track their 18 to 25-year-old kids using smartphone apps. NPR's Allison Aubrey says the top reason parents give is to give them peace of mind about their child's safety.
Researchers at the University of Michigan surveyed about 1,500 parents of young adults and found 52% track their adult kid's location. Sarah Clark, who co-directs the survey, says parents of 18 to 20-year-olds were more likely to track compared to those who had kids 21 to 25. She said many parents say they want to know their child's whereabouts to make sure they're safe.
The majority of time it is location tracking is always on.
About 25% of parents say tracking may lead to anxiety more than reassurance, and experts say tracking can be a good way to stay in communication, but it should not be used as a way to micromanage an adult child's life. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Award-winning children's author Jane Yolen has died at the age of 87 at her Massachusetts home, according to a family statement. Jane Yolen wrote 450 books. That included the classic about the Holocaust, The Devil's Arithmetic, and the winner of the Caldecott Medal, Owl Moon. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, committed to providing perpetual access to print and digital books for libraries and the communities they serve. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
KEXE has been serving the community of northern Minnesota since 1976. I'm Heidi Holton, and Simon Gretton recently stopped by and told us why he supports KEXE.
The dearth of local news in rural America is, frankly, I think, a big problem for our democracy. And the model right here of KEXE filling in and having outstanding public radio reporters filling the news gap in a rural area like ours, if the whole country had that, then our democracy would be so much the better for it. First heard about that. Wow, I want to get behind that. So I've been upping my support ever since I heard about that, and I will be continuing to do so because that is just a gift and asset to our neighborhoods, to our towns, to our region and the country and the world.
Do your part. Go to KEXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The United States and Iran say they are ready to stop their nearly four-month war.
The president started the war by saying a U.S. bombing campaign would set up Iran's people to overthrow their government. That government is still in power, and Trump now makes an agreement with it. In recent weeks, reports of the terms have included payments to Iran to stop the fighting, although the actual terms are unknown. It is thought to be a temporary deal to end the shooting and return to negotiating the hard issues, including the status of Iran's nuclear program.
NPR's Kerry Kahn joins us now from Tel Aviv. So, Kerry, President Trump announced this final agreement on his social media platform, posting Sunday evening. What do you have to say?
He portrayed it as a victory for the U.S. and that once it is signed this Friday in Geneva, the U.S. naval blockade of Iranian ports will end. Trump says the Strait of Hormuz will be open and free to all. And he added, ships of the world, start your engines, let the oil flow. Oil prices did drop on news of a deal. Iran is also claiming the deal as a victory. Iran's deputy foreign minister said the cessation of fire will be immediate and on all fronts, and he did state that includes Lebanon.
Okay, so details, Kerry. What do we know about any details here?
Not a lot. Lots of questions remain. But Trump says the Strait's opening will happen after the deal is signed on Friday. That's in Geneva. And it will begin with a sweeping of the vital waterway of all mines. He said in the past that the pact would entail a 60-day ceasefire while both sides begin negotiations on a permanent end to the war. And then comes the really tough issues like Iran's nuclear capabilities and sanctions relief. In an interview with the New New York Times last night, Trump said Iran would be allowed low-level nuclear enrichment, but what that looks like is unknown. And then there's the role of Israel in all of this deal. Israel has not been part of talks leading up to the agreement, and as of now is not expected at the future negotiations.
Okay, so what has Iran said about this deal?
Iran's Supreme National Security Council confirmed the deal, too. It said it was agreed to and that Iran expects fighting on all fronts to end, including Lebanon. The semi-official state news agency Meres did have a lengthy 14-point draft of what Iran says is in the Memorandum of Understanding with the U.S. Most important, and this could be another wrench in finalization of the deal, Iran says the U.S. will release $24 billion in blocked funds during the 60-day ceasefire. And they said that half of that amount, quote, must be made available to Iran before further negotiations begin. No word from Washington on that point.
Okay, and what about Israel? What are they saying?
Officially, Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, posted a response that also cast doubt about Israel's cooperation and U.S. control over its military actions. He said both he and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agree Israel will not retreat from Lebanon, where it's fighting Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants, or Syria or Gaza. And he added that is, quote, despite all the existing pressures and those that may yet come, Israel struck a Beirut suburb Sunday after detecting Hezbollah drones in northern Israel, and that cross-border clash almost scuttled yesterday's announcement of the deal.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Tel Aviv. Carrie, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Karim Sajidpour has been listening with us. He is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and has covered Iran for many years. Karim, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be with you.
Based on what you know so far, is the United States getting anything out of this agreement that it did not already have before the war?
Steve, I think it's important to judge the success of this war against President Trump's own words. When he launched the war on February 28th, he claimed he was going to further obliterate Iran's nuclear program, raise its missile production to the ground, defang its regional proxies, and potentially even unseat the Iranian regime. He called for Iran's unconditional surrender. And unfortunately, none of that has happened. What we have achieved with this phase one agreement is essentially reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which was open before the war. So the short answer to your question is that nothing has been achieved in the last 4 months that wasn't already there.
Well, we heard Kerry Khan say the Iranians claim they're getting a $24 billion payment here. $24 billion of their own frozen assets come back to them. A U.S. official is telling Axios in the last few hours that that is wrong. But then the U.S. official says this is pay for performance, which sounds like the United States is, in fact, paying. Do you expect money for Iran just needs to be part of this deal?
So one of the sources of contention between the United States and Iran is whether Iran will be paid up front in any deal or whether it will be a performance for relief, as U.S. officials put it. I think that there is going to be money exchanging hands even for phase one of this deal. It seems more likely that the United States has asked some of its Gulf partners to unfreeze Iranian assets in those countries to provide Iran some economic relief. But as I said, see, this is only phase one. Phase two is meant to be negotiating the nuclear issue. We've given ourselves 60 days to resolve that issue. It's highly unlikely that that's going to be resolved in 60 days.
I think I hear you saying that the money is going to flow to Iran. The question really is just the timing, what happens in what order. This is a sensitive topic. Earlier this month, we heard from the Trump administration on Morning Edition. State Department spokesperson Tommy Pigott took some questions, and let's listen to one exchange. Under what circumstances would the United States be willing to send money to Iran, if any?
Well, the president being clear on Truth Social that there is going to be no exchange of money over the short term here, or no imminent exchange of money.
No imminent exchange of money, again, leaving open that there's going to be money at some point. What makes this politically sensitive, the idea of allowing billions of dollars to go to this particular government in Iran?
Well, it's because President Trump called Obama's nuclear deal, the 2015 JCPOA, the worst deal in history, because it had provided Iran about $1.5 billion in economic relief in order to make a nuclear compromise. And this time around, President Trump has launched a war that has perhaps cost American taxpayers north of $100 billion. And not only did he not attain his demand for total surrender, but it appears that we'll also be needing to pay Iran perhaps significantly more money in order to get it for a nuclear compromise. So this is obviously a very sensitive point for President Trump.
Wait a minute. Instead of $1.5 billion, the United States is talking about tens of billions of dollars initially?
So in the context of a potential nuclear deal, the money that is on the table being talked about is indeed in the tens of billions of dollars. Now, what the United States is hoping for is something broader than just a nuclear deal, a deal in which Iran will really change its revolutionary identity, stop opposing America and Israel, stop supporting its regional proxies. But I think it's clear that Iran has no intention of doing that.
Is this money that the Iranian government can use to support itself?
This is money that Iran will use to double down and fortify its regime, most likely to rebuild its proxy network, rebuild its missile network. There's zero indication that this is a regime which is rethinking its revolutionary identity. If anything, they're doubling down on it.
It also sounds like President Trump, based on his interview with the New York Times, accepts that Iran is going to have some nuclear activity in the end of the nuclear agreement that has yet to be negotiated, accepting that Iran will demand something, which was also true of that agreement he rejected when he ended it in 2018. Do you have a sense of what would make this potential agreement any better than what the president considered unacceptable in the past?
So the only metric in which it could be a slight improvement on Obama's nuclear deal is that Obama's nuclear deal allowed Iran to enrich uranium at very low levels. What President Trump is hoping for is that Iran will agree to a suspension of enrichment for perhaps 10 years, 15 years before it's allowed again, low-level enrichment. It remains to be seen whether that is achievable. And in my view, even if it is achievable, it won't vindicate the enormous cost of this war.
Karim, I know that you've spent a lot of time with Iranians. You've lived in Iran in the past. What does this agreement mean for the people of Iran?
Well, I think for the people in Iran, this war has been the worst of both worlds, and that it has seemingly further entrenched a very brutal regime that killed potentially tens of thousands of Iranians last January. And it's clear to people in Iran there's no external saviors here. You know, President Trump said help is on the way. He was going to help the Iranian people. And if anything, he's done the opposite. I think this war has revived a regime which I described as a zombie regime, one with a dying ideology, dying legitimacy. And President Trump also shifted the global conversation on Iran, whereas in January the world was talking about the Iranian regime's brutal massacre of its own people. Now Iran has been made to look like more of a victim, and in some places even a hero in withstanding this war by America and Israel.
Are there people who oppose the government in Iran who feel betrayed now?
100%. I think that's probably a widespread sentiment that President Trump threw the Iranian people under the bus.
Karim, thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Karim Sajidpour is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking on this morning that we are learning more gradually about a peace agreement, a tentative one, between the United States and Iran. We'll continue to bring you more information as we learn it. It's NPR News.
It is 6:19. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News. This week, an incident on a Minneapolis lacrosse field is raising questions about safety and respect in youth sports. And in Onamia, the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post is marking 30 years with a community celebration. And before 7 o'clock, we'll hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. She'll share her top 10 favorite birds. You can answer our question of the week. This week, we want to know about your favorite ways to eat ice cream. What are your favorite flavors, favorite treats, or toppings? Text in 218-326-1234. Most area farmers markets are now open for the season. Go to kaxe.org. Look for local events to find a map of area markets. And the Tuesday Summer Concert Series continues in Grand Rapids each Tuesday at noon. Tomorrow, percussionist Brady Kaysen and friends will perform at Grace Bible Church. Northwoods Run Club meets every Thursday, 5 o'clock at Giants Ridge near Bowabic. All ages and paces are welcome. An optional meal follows. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. 1 hour from now, it is Events Up North. Andrew DeZingle and I will take a closer look at this week's events.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors aim to provide customized advice to bring their clients' ideas of performance to life. Learn more at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Cigna Healthcare. At Cigna Healthcare, they're dedicated to being there through life's everyday and extraordinary health moments. Learn more at cigna.com/better. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Monday morning, and we're with you on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Anna Mae Martinez, across the country, there are some people who are angry about data centers. Opposition to new facilities often comes from grassroots activism, or does it? NPR's Jeff Brumfield looked into claims of a sinister plot to undermine data center growth.
Last month at an event titled Harnessing American Power, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum was upset by growing local opposition to data centers. And Burgum claimed it wasn't what it seemed.
It's not organic and local. Some of this is foreign sourced dark money.
Over on the podcast All In, which is hosted by a group of tech multimillionaires who call each other besties, there was also talk of foreign influence, specifically from China. Fund manager Gavin Baker was recently on the show.
It is starting to feel or seem like there may be a CCP-funded campaign.
The theory is that China is paying local groups of people to oppose data centers. The idea of a Chinese plot is catching on among the tech investors backing data center construction, people like Canadian multimillionaire Kevin O'Leary. He made his name on the TV show Shark Tank, and now he's an investor in a giant data center in Utah. It will be larger than Manhattan. When local opposition began to build,
we dug in. I got my guys to go a deep dig into the IP addresses, and here's what we found out. This is fascinating.
And he claims to have found evidence for Chinese influence.
We found two cells inside of Utah, Alliance for a Better Utah.
We'll come back to them in a second. The other one?
Elevate Strategies, also a cell operating inside of Utah. Gabby Finlayson. Gabby, what are you doing?
I called Gabby Finlayson, a senior partner at Elevate Strategies.
Today it's nice, actually. It's been like really weird, I feel like, lately, but it's very nice today.
Elevate Strategies is a consulting firm based in Salt Lake that helps Democratic candidates to run for office in Utah and elsewhere. She says she has no idea why Kevin O'Leary decided her firm was a Chinese cell seeking to undermine his data center project.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have been as confused as anybody.
Elevate has mentioned the data center on social media, but nobody's paying them to do it, she says. Finlayson is from Utah, born and raised. She admits she did live outside the state for a while, but she wasn't in China.
Yeah, I don't know. Iowa doesn't look a lot like Beijing.
What about that other organization, Alliance for a Better Utah? Well, I called them too, and they were equally perplexed.
I grew up watching Shark Tank occasionally with my dad. I'm like, why is this guy talking about us?
Elizabeth Hutchings is the communications director for Alliance for a Better Utah, a small progressive nonprofit also based in Salt Lake City. O'Leary name-checked people who didn't even work there anymore. And he claimed
there was evidence that millions of dollars were being funneled from the Chinese Communist Party to us. You know, it was such an outrageous claim. We laughed.
In fact, they found it so funny, they made a fundraising video mocking the idea on social media. They displayed a hammer and sickle while asking for donations from local Utahans. They're also suing on behalf of citizens who claim they weren't adequately consulted about the project. So is there any evidence that China is trying to stoke U.S. opposition to data centers?
We haven't found much.
Darren Linville is head of the Digital Forensics Lab at Clemson University, which tracks foreign influence campaigns online. China, like a lot of countries, controls armies of social media bots that can try to sway the online discourse. But Linville says they're not talking much about this topic. And Chinese state media appears much more intent on promoting Chinese data centers.
China tends to care a lot more about what you think about China and China's economy than they do about what you think of your neighbor or what's happening in your own backyard here in the United States.
Linville says he can't completely rule out that the Chinese are quietly paying influencers or others to oppose data centers, but he points out there's no need. A recent Gallup poll found 71% of Americans oppose data center construction in their communities.
I think in this case, the people talking about data centers are real people with real passions and real perspectives and real opinions.
In Utah, those people appear to have forced Kevin O'Leary to scale back his plans. After the president of the Utah Senate raised concerns, he agreed to shrink his data center project to a quarter of its original size. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Some other news now. A plane crashed in Butler, Missouri on Sunday. 12 people were killed. Here's Madeline Fox with our member station KCUR.
The single-engine turboprop took off around 11:30 a.m. from Butler Memorial Airport. It was carrying 11 skydivers plus the pilot, authorities said. The Pacific Aerospace 750 XL plane came down minutes after taking off. Bates County Sheriff Chad Anderson says investigators think that it was an accident.
We just want to reassure the public that there's nothing criminal that we can see, nothing terrorism related or anything like that. Those are some of the first questions that we would have with the World Cup being in town. And we just want to make sure that the public knows that they're safe.
Kansas City is one of the 11 U.S. cities hosting FIFA World Cup games and expects hundreds of thousands of visitors. Skydive Kansas City, the company that owned the plane, called the crash a, quote, devastating loss. The company said it's collaborating with the National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Aviation Administration. Of the 11 passengers, 7 were single jumpers preparing to skydive solo. 4 were tandem jumpers preparing to go in pairs. Authorities have not yet released the victims' names or any identifying information. Sheriff Anderson said family members were at the Butler Memorial Airport at the time of the crash.
There's nothing we really can say to make it better. We just pray for them and their loved ones and their friends and their family and hope that they can recover to some sense of normalcy if we can.
Congressman Mark Alford, who represents the Butler area, told KMBC9 that the investigation will take months, possibly years.
Just getting to enjoy God's green earth and then have something like this turn so tragic while potentially other family members were watching, it's tragic.
According to the FAA, the aircraft certification was active until January 2030. Butler Memorial Airport is popular with skydivers. For NPR News, I'm Madeline Fox in Kansas City.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, Visa and OpenAI are working together. Their goal is to let AI chatbots become your personal shopper, not just suggesting what to get, but actually buying it. So what happens when they go on a spending spree? Listen in the NPR app or on this public radio station. Human beings bringing you the news. It's NPR News.
Paul Rudnick has always been obsessed with spy thrillers. The gadgets, the car chases, the luxurious backdrops. His new book has them all, plus a top secret LGBTQ spy agency.
These are the people who are often overlooked or underestimated, and yet there they are at the very center of power.
Rudnick on the Tuxedo Society on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 6:29. Thanks for listening to People Powered, KAXC, and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a moment, Minnesota Native News, and then we'll hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. And before 7 o'clock, we're going to hear a story from a recent Storytelling for Spirit and Courage event with Frank Bebo. We're going to hear a story from him. Temperatures right now, we've got 48 in Hibbing, 49 in Bemidji, 50 in Grand Rapids, 48 in Brainerd, and 50 in Bagley. For today, mostly sunny with a slight chance of showers late this afternoon. High 73 to 77, breezy west wind up to 25 miles per hour. Chance of showers and thunderstorms overnight with lows 43 to 48. And tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny. High 67 to 71. Winds from the northwest, 5 to 10, gusting higher. And tomorrow night, lows in the upper 40s, slight chance for showers. And then on Wednesday, good chance for rain. Possible thunderstorms with highs in the mid-60s. Programming is supported by Grand Dental Center, where Drs. Lisa Johnson, Leanna McBride, and their staff provide full-service family dental care for patients of all ages in Grand Rapids and surrounding communities. More information at granddentalcenter.com. Right now, it is time for Minnesota Native News.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, questions about safety and respect in youth sports. And in Nonamia, the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post is marking 30 years with a community celebration. First, allegations of homophobic and racial language at a high school lacrosse game are opening a discussion about safety and representation in the sport. Reporter Dan Ninham has the story.
During a recent Minnesota State High School League lacrosse game, a Native player for TriMac alleged getting called homophobic and racial slurs from a member of the opposing team, Brick.
My son has longer hair. He has our medicine colors on his lacrosse stick. He's very proud about his Lakota heritage.
Lewis Charging Bear is the father of Gino Charging Bear.
There was a defenseman there that was saying very insensitive remarks that would be considered homophobic. The F word was used multiple times on him, making fun of him being an American Indian.
Growing up in lacrosse and hockey, especially in the late 90s and 2000s, I think I took for granted how ubiquitous micro and macro aggressions, patriarchy, racism, homophobia was just kind of always there.
Aaron Lipkin is the co-founder and president of Homegrown Lacrosse, a Minneapolis nonprofit, and serves as the fiscal manager of the Indigenous Lacrosse Alliance.
I'm one of the only openly queer male coaches within modern lacrosse in the country.
As a coach, Aaron has learned firsthand how to support athletes in these situations.
You got to hope that the official is receptive. The tricky thing is, if they don't hear it or see it, how do you address that? From the leagues and schools perspective, same thing. Follow up, make sure people feel heard. And then if it's getting reported, then addressing it with them directly and then looking further to say, hey, what am I doing as an institution, a school, or a league to foster a more inclusive and accepting environment?
I also would pose the question to the adults, or coaches, referees, athletic directors, the league representatives. Are we doing our best to create safe spaces for athletes to come forward with their concerns?
John Hunter, who is Muscogee Creek, Winnebago, and White Earth Ojibwe, is the head coach of the Minneapolis Varsity Boys Lacrosse Team and the director of Twin Cities Native Lacrosse.
Success in fighting racism is to have zero incidents happen during a season.
For Lewis, maintaining a safe and respectful sports environment is a need for all parents.
We deserve our children to be safe, to not be harassed, to not be targeted, to feel like they're equal as anybody else playing these games. The game has all kinds of good medicine around it, and I think that has been our guiding light.
For Minnesota Native News, I'm Dan Ninham.
Next, reporter Chaz Wagner speaks with staff from the Mille Lacs Band Museum about the anniversary events.
This year marks a special milestone for the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post in Onamia as the museum celebrates 30 years in its current location with the community anniversary program set for Saturday, June 13th. Lily Lauer is the program supervisor at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum.
We're doing stuff throughout the entire year to amp up it being the anniversary. We are having Benjamin Sam come to the event, and he's going to be demoing some of his art. He is also our Artist of the Month.
The celebration invites visitors to experience interactive exhibits, guided tours, and family activities.
We'll have speeches by Nina Archibald.
Nina Archibald is the former director of the Minnesota Historical Society, or MNHS. She oversaw the multi-year development and construction of the new museum building, the collaborative effort with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe.
We'll also be piloting walking tours this summer, starting on the June 13th event. The trading post experience is pretty unique because it is still an active trading post. There's not a lot of those in the country. And then especially having all Native-made products, objects, and art. It's always been about the Mille Lacs Band here. So it's always been Native-focused, Native-centered.
The celebration runs from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post, just north of Onamia on Highway 169, and is free to tribal members. For details, visit mnhs.org. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Chaz Wagner.
Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. It's 6:36. It's the Monday morning show here on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Joining me now is Andrew DeZingle. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a beautiful Monday.
It is. Blue skies. I've been enjoying the cooler weather, although Saturday was a little too chilly.
Tell you what, Jennifer, when you're moving an apartment,
oh, yeah,
when it's that cool, it's perfect.
Right.
I was still in shorts and still moving.
Okay, good. I was at Festival Rialto on Saturday.
Oh, that's right.
And, people, I saw all kinds of attire, mm-hmm. I would say, from people that I looked at and I thought, ooh, aren't you cold, to people who had, you know, full-on winter jackets, hats.
What was the flip-flop situation?
Non-socked feet.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause, you know, like, especially in college, and we both went to Bemidji State University,
mm-hmm.
there's always those people that would, even when it's like 20 below, are still wearing like shorts and flip-flops to class.
Right.
And so I assume that's just something you'll have to deal with for the rest of your life kind of thing, where you're always going to run into those kind of guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, everyone has their own preferences and stuff. I'm not trying to judge. I guess I kind of was sounding judgy, but do what you have to do.
What was the scarf situation?
There were some scarfs.
Nice.
Yep.
Any KXC scarfs?
I didn't see any.
Oh.
No. But it was a good time.
Excellent.
Yep. Great time. And
I saw some clips from Wild Horses performing, and that looked like a lot of fun.
Good. I did not stick around that late, but I'm glad people had fun. And coming up on the 27th of June, we've got Beltrami Block Party in downtown Bemidji. We're co-hosting that with Bridget's Pub, Keg and Cork. And that will feature Eric Koskinen, David Huckfeldt, Little Fevers, and more. There'll be food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. I can find more on our Facebook page. And this free event is made possible thanks to the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Yeah, I'm super excited for Little Fevers. They got little jangly pop type sound that I think is going to be super fun on the for like a street dance type vibe.
Yeah, I think so too. That's Lucy Michelle's band.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, super, super pumped for that.
You know, live music is great. You know what? I always say this to my friend Tammy Bobrowski. You never regret a show you go to, you know?
Yeah.
That's what it is about live music. You always regret the shows you don't go to.
Right. So get out there, especially this one. It's, you know, free opportunity
for live music.
So we're looking forward to that one. Coming up in a bit, we're going to have a story from a Stay Human storytelling event with Frank Bebo. But right now it is time for Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
The idea of ranking beloved people or birds on any top 10 list seems ludicrous to me, a task somewhere between prohibitively difficult and impossible. Choosing favorites among birds feels akin to choosing favorites among my children. My connection to each is unique and special. That said, the black-capped chickadee earned its place as number one because of all the birds, that's the one that really does feel like part of my immediate family. The chickadee was not just the first bird I ever saw when I started birding. To figure out what species it was, I had to spend quite a few minutes searching through my field guide, and the little bird was so cosmically obliging, not just staying within view, but very close to me, sometimes even making eye contact as I figured out who it was. And that entire first spring, chickadees did not just show up virtually every time I went out. They also seemed to bring friends for me to add to my life list, especially warblers. I wasn't at all surprised to learn that many small neotropical migrants associate with chickadees as they pass through strange areas. I'd seen firsthand that this was true. When we moved to Duluth, chickadees were the first birds to visit my feeder and then to feed out of my hand. One with a deformed bill and foot specifically befriended me. He was obviously looking for literal handouts, but the confiding way he looked for me, alighted on my hand, and sat there eating so he could use my fingers to help him wedge a mealworm into a position that he could manage to swallow, captured my heart. His elongated upper bill broke off in the spring, and that's when I confirmed that he was a male by his frequent singing by my window. He didn't attract a mate that year, but the next he did and successfully raised young. I'll never forget my joy and pride watching him feeding his babies. I worked at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology from 2010 to 2012, right when several researchers there were working on chickadee projects. That's when I got to watch them get banded, see inside their nests, and see exactly how such a friendly, confiding little bird is no wimp. Chickadees may willingly alight on our hands, but it's strictly on their terms. They have a nasty bite when held against their will. In 2021, when we were hunkered down at home during the pandemic, a pair of chickadees nested at eye level in our dead cherry tree, giving me all kinds of opportunities to watch them excavating the cavity, building the nest within, and feeding the young. They even let me make a video of the last one fledging. And when the babies got skillful at flying, the parents frequently brought them to our yard while I was out there, giving me wonderful insights into chickadee family life. And those backyard chickadees coming constantly to the feeder in my home office window caught my baby grandson's eye, too. One of the very first words he learned was Dee Dee. And after he learned that his other grandmother was called Nana, he himself came up with the name Dee Dee Nana for me, the name he still calls me. Those two old saws, familiarity breeds contempt, and absence makes the heart grow fonder, don't work for me. I guess a person who is still happy with the spouse she married in 1972 would, of course, have a special love for the bird who sticks with her every day the whole year round, personally engages with her, and genuinely seems to like her. So in the same way that I have a special love for my husband, children, and grandchild, I have a special love for the black-capped chickadee, the bird who is and always will be number one on my life list and in my heart. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com.
You know, I just watched a movie recently where a bird plays a huge role in it.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. It's called Disclosure Day. It's the new Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah. How is it?
It's okay.
Yeah.
Some people love it a lot more than I do.
Okay.
But there's some parts that just don't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But a cardinal plays a big role in it. So.
Ooh, a cardinal.
Which is my friend Holland and Dringa's favorite bird.
There you go.
What's your favorite bird?
Flicker.
Oh, okay. I'm a blue jay guy.
Because they're blue.
Yeah.
I like flickers because they look like if a kid drew a bird, that's what you'd get.
Oh.
Because they've got like dots. They've got all kinds of, they've got a little color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're pretty cool.
And it's that time of year. Get to see all the birds again.
Yeah. I've heard we've had some brown thrashers outside our window here at KAXC. I have not seen them yet, but I know this is the time of the year that they're usually out and about right outside our window. They're often down in the dirt.
So. And usually I see a rabbit out here, but I don't see one yet today.
Oh, I'm sure they're out there.
Where's the little bunny?
Come on, bunnies. Show yourselves. So it is the Monday Morning Show. That is Andrew DeZingle. I'm Jennifer Barr. Andrew, since you're here, I want to run down some national days.
Oh, okay.
It's National Nature Photography Day. You a fan of the old nature photography?
I enjoy nature photography.
I like looking at it. I don't know that I'm good at it.
Well, I had to take a photography class in college, but I don't remember having to take nature shots. It was like we had to go to events and take photos. But I guess I never dabbled in the nature part of it. You know,
yeah.
What would be probably the best time is like when you go cross-country skiing and it's like the fresh snow, but early in the morning where like the snow is reflecting crystally.
Ooh, yeah.
That would be some great photos.
Mm-hmm. Or I like when you like, and you can get like the frost on something.
Yeah. When the trees are like all frosty.
Yeah.
That'd be sweet.
It's also Megalodon Day.
Megalodon.
Which are a prehistoric giant shark.
Oh, well, finally we're showing some appreciation for the Megalodon. Have you ever seen the Meg?
No.
Or the Meg 2.
Oh, the movie? No, I have not.
Yeah.
No.
With Jason Statham, I believe.
Okay. It's also National Prune Day.
Where do I stand on prunes? I don't know if I've ever actually had a prune.
Scott Hall, when he sat by me when he was still working full-time here, would give me prunes all the time.
Really? What would you do with them?
Eat them.
Just like eat them straight up?
They'd be all sticky. I'd be like, I guess I got to eat this. And he'd say, did you have your medicine today?
Can you juice a prune?
Yeah, there's prune juice. Like, you can buy that at the store.
So, like, if I put them in a blender, would that be good enough? Or do I have to, like, squeeze them like an orange?
I don't know, because there'd be, like, the skin part. That, I don't know exactly how they do that.
Well, isn't some fruits where, like, the skin is, like, the part that's actually good for you?
Yeah, but wouldn't prune juice just be, like, plum juice?
That's what I assume. I don't know what the correlation anymore of, like, these certain fruits. Like, are raisins grapes?
Yes.
Okay, and what did you say before prunes?
Plums.
Plums. Plums are prunes? Ay, it's too much.
Today is also National Smile Power Day.
Oh.
So the power of a smile can be, you know, important and
infectious.
I'm hosting Headwaters today. That's going to be my request line theme, songs about smiles.
Songs about smiles. Here we go. If I play a song from the Beach Boys album Smile, would that count?
Maybe.
I don't know if they have any songs actually called Smile. I never actually listened to Smile by the Beach Boys.
Yeah, and then Brian Wilson released Smiley Smile? I don't know.
Or maybe I flipped it.
Yeah, I think that album had, you know, grand designs and it didn't quite work out the way.
Well, it was like the famous Lost Beach Boys album.
Yeah.
Much like the Zombies R.I.P., which they did release later.
Okay. So that's coming up at 10:30. You can text in your smile suggestion songs, 218-326-1234. Right now, we are going to hear a story from Frank Bebo. He has lived most of his life on Leech Lake Reservation, where he practiced law for White Earth and Leech Lake Reservations. And honor the earth and others on behalf of civil and sovereign rights. He spoke recently at Storytelling for Spirit and Courage, a live event at Clocko Brewing.
Okay, good evening. I apologize for being an attorney, but it happens. I
So I looked up on the internet, just because I am an attorney, just to see some of those words. So spirit and courage, and those are two different things, and they're kind of like a part of an equation. They're two of the things that go into who you are and what you want to be and how you might get there and whatever. And so when I look at courage, I look at sisu or ogichida. And so for the Finlanders, you know, you got your sisu, it's your perseverance, your guts, you're willing to, you start something, you keep doing it. And then the ogichida, that's more of the veteran or the brave or the, you know, the fighter in our language, the Ojibwe. So to start out with spirit, my friend Dale, he explained to me, he was a big drum, he was also a Madewan. He explained to me that we were spirits and we came to this planet and we wanted to live here because it was so beautiful. And so we had to ask if we could come and live, and we talked to the Creator, and the Creator petitioned all of creation and said that you can. But you have to remember us always. You have to remember us in our ceremonies. You have to remember that we're your relatives, we're your relations. And you have to watch out for us just like we're taking care of you. So really the first treaty is with the Creator, and it's about how you're going to live on Earth. And then after that, you know, you got your things that go on. So then the next part about spirituality for us would be our migration stories. You get the creation story, first treaty. The migration story is how we mostly got right here in northern Minnesota, Canada, Lake Superior, because of wild rice, where the food grows on the water. So spirituality from that standpoint is a different kind of spirituality than Christianity and the other things that are around. So from the courage side, law is kind of a weird thing. I didn't expect to have to go to law school. It's a commitment. You go your first semester, it was $5,000 or $6,000, I think. And you're going to have to start paying it back as soon as you quit, die, or graduate. And so you have to keep giving them money and keep going to school and then hopefully graduate and then hopefully pass the bar. And law school is kind of a funny place. I was about 38 when I went, and I'd been working for the Indian paper for a long time. And there's a lot of smart people in there. There's a lot of things going on that you don't exactly understand who's there and why. And you find out when you get out that we all went to the same law school. They teach you kind of state and federal law. But I came to live on the reservation. I came to work on the reservation. And so I was trying to understand how Indian law would work, and they really didn't teach Indian law. Hardly anybody teaches Indian law. And you really have to kind of figure it out on your own. And so you get frustrated. I was working against Line 3 for a long time with the new route that they were coming through. And what I came to find out was that I wanted to try to figure out how to bring these kinds of issues into tribal court rather than always going to state court or the Public Utilities Commission or some other place that decides. We never get to decide. We never get to say, hey, this stuff's important to us and we want it in your record, and then you can explain how you're going around our rights and our concerns. And that never really worked out. And so I kept trying to figure this out. And at the end of the pipeline fight, probably the last couple of years, I was telling all my brethren when we'd end our talk about how are we going to try to still resist Line 3, and I'd say, well, there's rights of Monoman. And they'd all look at me and they'd say, Frank, there's no such thing. I said, there is such a thing. I said, we've created it for tribal court, and, you know, I'm ready to use it. And they were probably more afraid than I was, I guess, because they were skeptical and didn't want me to even talk about it down in St. Paul. So I had to wait. Not long after I waited, Line 3, the Enbridge and all, they broke through the aquifers, and it ended up that the DNR issued a retroactive permit for 5 billion gallons of water. It came right out of the aquifers. You saw it come right out of the river. The water dropped down to about 8 inches right here. It has never recovered. You know, you got to have inflow stream to hold your water, and it's been lost. And so it ended up that Monoman, the first name plaintiff, the tribal council and a bunch of water protectors sued the Minnesota DNR in tribal court. It hadn't been done before, and I can tell you, even as a regular attorney who went through law school, it's hard to think that you can do that. But it's colonialism that holds you back. It's how you've been indoctrinated that holds you back. And if you don't try, then you'll regret that. And so I had to try. And interestingly enough, and I won't go into the long story, but when I went to federal court, the DNR was trying to get out of being in tribal court. They were trying to get out of being in tribal court in tribal court. Because they don't want to be in tribal court. They don't want the Indians being in control of anything, you know, much less them. They went to federal court essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, telling the court, we're sovereign. They can't sue us. Tell those Indians that they can't use their tribal law in tribal court against us. And the judge looked down at him and said, can you point to a law that gives me the right to tell those Indians that they can't use their law against you? And he just stood there. And that's when I knew it was over. Now, I didn't prevail in the long run, and I won't go into that long part of the story, but in the interim, a friend of mine who I'd been talking with for the last 15 years out in Seattle, he sued for the third time. Twice in federal court he had lost. The third time he used tribal court with the Sauk Seattle tribe suing on behalf of the salmon against the city of Seattle because they had three hydroelectric dams on the Skagit River preventing the salmon from getting up to where they live based on the treaty that the salmon were going to be there for them to eat. And so he used tribal court, and they were also in a FERC proceeding, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And as a result of having a federally recognized treaty, FERC would look at the city and say, well, we have a relationship through a treaty with these Indians. What are you going to do about their fish? And that's essentially what it was. And within about 6 or 8 months, they had already started working on essentially a consent decree. And that's where they're at now. And it just got issued for $1 billion for fish passageway on the Skagit River for three dams. Now, right, you know, you have to be willing to be stupid and try things that everybody tells you you can't do, you know, and it happens to all of us. But, so now I'm working with another tribe out on the East Coast because they're looking at doing a giant water extraction. It was originally 13 million gallons of water per day that they were going to pipe 35 miles for, in part, data centers. And this extraction is on the Rappahannock River, which is part of the Chesapeake Bay. And so a lot of it's tidal saltwater estuary. And so you have fish that migrate from the Atlantic right on up into the fresh water and go into the tributaries, and that's where they spawn. That's where the sturgeon go. That's where the blueback herring go. They've got oysters that have been there forever. And they also have wild rice. And so they're very glad to see me. So, sisu ogichida, stick to it, perseverance. All right.
That is Frank Bebo at a storytelling event supported in part by an artist equity grant from Arrowhead Regional Arts Commission with support from the McKnight Foundation. It is the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Andrew DeZingle.
We receive support from Brainstorm Bakery, headquarters of Crapola, with four flavors of granola handcrafted at the bakery on East Sheridan Street in Ely. Online ordering available and more at brainstormbakery.com.
Programming is also supported in part by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the 2026 Bush Fellows, leaders working to make the region better for everyone. More information online at bushfoundation.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, celebrating 50 years of People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org.
Mostly sunny today, slight chance of showers late this afternoon. High 73 to 77 with breezy west wind up to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, chance of showers and thunderstorms, lows 43 to 48. And tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, high 67 to 71. Winds from the north, 5 to 10, gusting higher. Close tomorrow night in the upper 40s with a slight chance of showers, and by Wednesday, good chance for rain, possible thunderstorms, and highs in the mid-60s. Coming up in just a moment, it is the Up North Report, local news from our region, and at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Andrew and I will take a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this week. And in our 8 o'clock hour, 8:45, it's Bright Spot. We're going to meet kid librarians from the Virginia Public Library along with their librarian, Crystal Macias. We're going to learn about that program and what it takes to be a kid librarian.
So I had a question for you, Jennifer, because you're hosting Headwaters, and mm-hmm. the request